Hello and welcome to the Tavern Chat podcast. Today we have another in our series of designer and makers fireside chats. Today I'm virtually sitting with Jacob from Nerdolopedia. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, pretty close. Most people struggle with it the first time.
Yeah, it's got a lot of letters there. I'm sorry.
Oh, and that's not a problem.
You're also with I believe Spongy Games.
That is correct. I'm actually the lead game designer for the Paths World of Idea RPG.
Okay. All right, we're going to have a lot to talk about.
Oh, absolutely.
So, before the show, Jacob and I were talking about cats. But I also explained to him that we have to have certain questions that we throw out there for everybody, and I'm going to start now throwing those questions at Jacob. So, Jacob.
Yes.
How did you get into role-playing? I mean, role-playing games. Like, what was your first experience like?
Well, my first experience with tabletop role-playing games was back, I believe, in 2010.
Okay.
And just to give, you're going to realize how young I actually am. I was in high school then.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm actually relatively young in this community. My first experience, I was actually at a video game kind of event where we all packed into a gymnasium with game consoles and all that. And someone was actually running Dungeons & Dragons 3.5. It was a short module or something that we'd go up and play, and that was my first time actually playing Dungeons and Dragons. And I remember playing a mage. And the most memorable experience I have from that was that our cleric had a Sturge latch onto him.
Ooh.
And I did not understand enough about the mechanics of the game. And I thought, okay, I've got some spells. Well, it's attached to him, so it's not, like, inside of him. And I decided to use Burning Hands to try to get it off.
Okay. I can already see where this is going. I like this.
The Sturge saved. The cleric did not. The cleric actually dropped it. Everyone at the table looked at me and went, why? It's like, I thought it would work. So,
I guess that's your first game. You're not quite sure about things like range and area of effect.
It was a lot more of like I was envisioning like trying to hit the Sturge with the edge of the cone, but mechanically that's not how it works. I would say nowadays I definitely rule sure that works because I'm a bit more lenient for that stuff. But
well, that is awesome though. That's memorable.
Yes. I do not remember the mage's name. I don't remember the dungeon master. I only remember that I basically killed our cleric in my first game. But then after that, I actually didn't play until I got into college, which honestly was about a year later. So, I played D&D 3.5, and then I actually kind of drifted away from D&D, and I started playing the Scion First Edition role-playing game.
Scion, that's the one that deals with
demigods.
Okay, but was that the World of Darkness?
No, that's system? A White Wolf system.
Okay.
Using the D10s, critical success. Yeah,
I can visualize the title and the cover of the book, but I never owned it. So,
yeah, they recently had a second edition Kickstarter, I think. I'm a little fuzzy on it because I wasn't following it nearly as much. But yeah, started getting into Scion, and then when I graduated college, I actually then got into Warhammer Fantasy. So I switched completely from role-playing games to tabletop war games. And eventually picked up D&D 5th edition. That was like after the Monster Manual came out and all that.
Okay.
But not before the Dungeon Master Guide came out. Or before the Dungeon Master's Guide came out. So, because a group of friends were like, oh, we want to play some D&D, but we don't know any DMs. So I learned how to DM, and I've never really stopped.
Oh, once you get pegged as a DM, you're a DM for life, man. I would probably have to guess that in my gaming career, I've probably been a DM for 85 to 90% of the sessions I've been part of.
Yeah, I'm in that same boat. It especially got bad when several of my players were like, oh my god, you're awesome at DMing. Can you just keep DMing? And I'm like, okay. Realistically, I do enjoy it very much. It is my preferred role. So.
Yeah, there's a lot to being a GM, and being a good GM requires a lot of skills that you don't necessarily think of offhand. Some people excel at being GMs because they're organized. That's not how I am, but I'm very good at improv and keeping the game going, which is why I don't mind doing convention games, and I do a lot of my gaming and running games at conventions, because I can keep a certain pace and I don't have to worry about internal consistency beyond the one session. When you do a lot of improv during an ongoing campaign, you better have somebody taking good notes for you, because
yeah,
you'll forget down the line some of the things that you've said, and some of the NPCs that come up, and it's like, oh yeah, I don't have notes on that. Oh, I've had it where I've had good players like, oh, I wrote everything down because I know you don't. I'm like, oh, thank you.
So interesting that you mentioned improv. Actually, the first game I was ever a game master to was the game Everyone is John.
Never heard of it.
It's a weird game, and I haven't found a consistent rule set to it. So when I did it, we basically just used a set of rules that we found and kind of modified it to work how it made sense for us. But all the players are voices in a character named John's head. And they're all vying for control over John to accomplish these certain tasks that they basically make for other players. So you write down three specific goals, and then they get shuffled together and passed out to everybody. So you don't know if you're going to get your own. And it can get really interesting.
That is, with the right group, that could play out really well. With the wrong group, it could be a slog. Yes.
It was very interesting because the way we played it, there was very much a lot of improv. There was one that the situation I started them out in was that John was on a boat out at sea. And they managed to convince John that, no, he wasn't actually out at sea. He was actually docked. And I had to shift the game entirely from being out at sea to being in some city that I can't remember where we had it. And things just escalated from there and were absolutely nuts, but absolutely fun.
Well, that's interesting. That would, you know, with the right group, that could play very well at a con game.
Oh yeah.
At a convention. Wow.
It is definitely designed for one shots, because the game goes until John dies.
Oh, well, there you go. Now I'm sure there's going to be some asshole players trying to kill John, but yes.
Oh, absolutely. if you're in the lead, because you get points whenever you complete goals, if you're in the lead, you're trying to kill John.
Oh, okay. I got, yeah, that makes a lot of sense now. I've got my position here. I'm ahead in points. If the game ends now, I win. Yeah, I can see that.
It is such a joy to play. We've had some incredibly crazy situations come up in it, and I am actually very happy that that was my first experience as a GM, because it allowed me for more crunchy systems to be able to roll with the punches. I do quite a bit of planning, but my planning is mostly just bullet points where it's like, oh, I'd like them to accomplish this. If they see this person, the person has these bullet points of information, but I plan nothing else besides that. because right. I assume my players are just going to ruin everything.
Well, it's like, yeah, that's like herding cats. It's damn near impossible.
Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of fun that way, though. So
nice. All right. Well, then it's a good follow-up question for us. Like, what's your go-to RPG system?
Currently, my go-to RPG system is D&D 5th edition. Okay. Mostly because that is the one that, rules-wise, I really got to know well. So being able to jump into D&D 5th edition is just really simple for me. That isn't to say that it's my preferred system. There's a lot of things about it that I've actually changed. I've done some tweaking of my own just to fit the way that I play games and the stories I tell.
Fair enough.
It's also the system that all my players know very well, so to be able to get a game going is fairly simple.
Well, you know, and that is important. I mean, I in my older years, I'm 51, I can't pick up new rule systems that are complicated as easily as I could when I was in high school and college. I mean, I used to own and pretty much buy anything that the small funds that we get from my part-time job could afford me. I went into gaming, and I would buy new systems like every other week, and I'd pick them up right away. Nowadays, even though 5e is certainly drawing upon older systems, D&D lineup, I don't know it well enough that I feel comfortable running it. I mean, I could probably play it as a player because the rules knowledge that you need as a player is more compartmentalized.
I have found that because I have such a good knowledge of the system itself, my players almost don't even need to know the rules. They just need to know their place within the game at that time and basically what's on their character sheet. Besides that, right. I've run several games for people who are brand new to tabletop role-playing games. And they've walked away like, oh my god, that's so much fun. I need to buy dice. I need to get games. I need to get a group together. And I'm just like, that makes me so happy.
And that's what it should be about. That's the whole joy of it. And like, I can run Swords and Wizardry without having to open up the rule book, which means that I can put my effort into the adventure and the session and my players.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing that I ever, you know, what I really hate is when you're playing a game and then some obscure rule comes up and it's like, oh my god, now I gotta take 5 minutes out of the game to look up the rule and then interpret the rule to the current situation. Ugh. Because that just ruins the whole flow.
That's one of the few reasons why for a while I was actually very closely following Jeremy Crawford. Because okay. he would answer clarifying questions about some rules. I read Sage Advice. I stopped doing it after a while because I realized he was repeating answers a lot because people were asking the same questions over and over and not really looking elsewhere.
Right.
But I dove into 5th edition headfirst. I've read the rule book so many times. There's few rules that I don't know off the top of my head. And if I don't know it right away, I know roughly what page it is in the book.
Okay.
So for me, it's very quick to find it, or because I've also now, since I've spent so much time also, I've worked at designing games in general for since I was in college, because I was originally trying to get into video game development. So I was doing a lot of studying of game design itself. And so sometimes I will make a ruling there if I think it is better, instead of looking up the rules itself, because that's just tedious and time-consuming, especially if you're streaming the game.
Oh, if you're streaming the game and people are going to be watching, yeah, they don't need that. Unless you plan on cutting out that 5-minute break, you know, later on. You can't do it when you're live. You know, it's like, what? Excuse me, yeah, everybody take a bio break. I've got to look.
Yeah. We usually resolve those questions. We do have a mid break where we all use the bathroom, because sitting there for 4.5 hours straight without moving.
Yeah, no.
You need to get up and move.
Yeah, I'd be a cripple at that point. I'd get up like a man.
Yeah, even during the stream, I have a stool and I stand up and I'll push the stool in. I'll pull the stool out, sit down. So I'm standing up and down, up and down, up and down, because apparently I'm restless.
Well, it's interesting because, like, when I run games at conventions, I do not sit. I will stand for the whole game, except for maybe the 10-minute break that we take in the middle for people to run off to the bathroom. I stand because I find that in a face-to-face game, I need to move around. I need to make sure I'm grabbing my player's attention, especially when the focus is on a certain player. Mm-hmm. And I need to stand. I've tried sitting it, and it just my feet at best becomes a place for me to store my books on. or even other times, she's like, oh, an additional player wants to jump in that wasn't on the list. Take my seat because I don't need it. That being said, when I run games using a virtual tabletop, I sit my ass down except for the bio breaks.
Yeah.
Because standing is not going to make a difference. It's not like, oh, I'm going to stand up and my players are going to become more focused on me.
Yeah.
You have to use different techniques when you're using a VTT.
Mm-hmm. Which I ran a virtual tabletop for, I want to say, a year and a half. And while I enjoyed being able to play with a group of friends, they were all college buddies I had, but we had all moved away from each other.
Right.
We played for a year and a half, and there were certain limitations to it that personally I didn't enjoy as much. I definitely see why it's so good for the community, and I do not condemn anyone who's like, oh, well, I only play virtual tabletops. It's like, awesome, you're playing games. But for me, I very much prefer the in-person experience. Just as a dungeon master, it makes it easier for me to kind of help control the flow of the table.
There's certain, because a physical presence allows you to grab somebody's focus.
Mm-hmm.
You can direct your voice and your gaze at a certain player and grab them in, where with a virtual tabletop, somebody you won't even know sometimes, and somebody's, you know, playing on their phone. Well, you get that at conventions too.
Yeah.
You get that at regular face-to-face games a bit, but yeah, it's easier to grab somebody's attention in a face-to-face game. But the convenience of playing on a VTT, you know, to be honest, I wasn't in a game for like almost a year and a half. Now I'm in two games as a player. I can't believe that shit. Yeah. But it's on virtual tabletops with people that I've known in the community now for years. I have a great time because I know the folks. If you're playing with people that you don't know, sometimes it's hard enough to get the chemistry working at a table, mm-hmm. like a face-to-face game. It takes even longer a lot of times at a virtual tabletop to get somebody, because you're not getting to know the person, because you're not getting that same vibe that you can get in person. It takes longer, I think, for that, I guess, that trust level, or whatever you talk about it, to build.
That level of personal interaction is really the reason why. So I guess this is getting a little bit into one of the things I do. For Nerdlopedia, as you've probably guessed, we stream our D&D game.
Right.
We are all in person when we are streaming. So the phones thing, I'm more lenient on because my players use them to access resources, but I also have them because they're in chat. They're in chat interacting with our audience, also moderating, because we don't have an official moderator that's outside of our table yet. But that level of personal interaction, people can see that chemistry between us that you can't even get over a webcam.
Right.
Webcam, in my opinion, is not a suitable replacement for that in-person connection that you make with players. It, you can get facial expressions and see a few more things, but it's really not the same. So.
Oh yeah, it's definitely two, not totally different, distinct and different worlds, but I mean, I was in a long wording group using Roll20. We played for years, and
mm-hmm.
at that point, we certainly had the same type of synergy and interaction and ball busting that you would get in a face-to-face group. But it took longer for that to come together.
Absolutely.
Using a VTT than it would have if you had a regular face-to-face group. I was in a face-to-face group that played twice a month at a local, well, when I say local game store, I still had to drive about an hour and 15 minutes out to Long Island to play.
Yeah, that's local.
Yeah, but it's local enough. But that you learned the bonding took place a lot quicker
mm-hmm.
in that group than it does in an online group. Now, again, not saying it doesn't happen in online group.
Yeah,
but absolutely. Just a slower process.
Yes. I am very fortunate that the Neuralopedia group as a whole, that we are physically close enough together to be able to do this.
Right.
We'd probably still play for stream if we were separated, but I find for us it's just so much more engaging because people can see the connection and the personal feeling between all the players, and it's. For us, it's a fun time.
Oh, you know what? That's all that matters, right?
Exactly.
All right. Let's let you see this. We're just the basic questions are taking us in directions that we didn't plan on, and that's the whole great thing about this. All right, so I'm going to ask you a question, and it's going to. You're mostly a 5e GM, so.
Mm-hmm.
Save or die. As a game mechanic, it's probably less of an issue for your players in the older rule sets because it's a lot easier to generate a new character. But as a 5e DM, how do you feel about the save or die mechanic?
So I would like you to expand on save or die just a little bit because I have something that I think is save or die, but I'm not sure if it's the same thing that you're talking about.
Sure.
What I'm thinking it is, it's you make a saving throw. If you fail, you die.
Basically.
Okay. From my personal gaming standpoint, I don't think one roll should take you all the way down. Like, so if a player's at full health and they roll and they just fail, I don't think that should kill them. To me, I am far more interested in personal choices resulting in death. That doesn't say that, oh, you failed that saving throw, you're not gonna die. I've told all of my players, you make stupid mistakes, you will die. Or as one of my friends puts it hilariously, play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
There you go.
In fact, in our stream game, we actually had a player almost die from a creature that they knew was in the city. He made a stupid mistake. Only the roll of the dice that I made behind the screen kept him remotely alive because he aged by 76 years overnight.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, there was a youth-eating monster running around the city, and he decided to sleep on the roof that night. Not the smartest choice.
Because everybody sleeps on a roof, man. Didn't you know that?
Not in this town. In the town they're in, we actually have a t-shirt. And I apologize if I don't know if swearing is fine on the shirt. Show.
You can fucking say whatever you want. We have no filters. There you go.
Good. We have a t-shirt that says it's official fuck River Tan. Which is nice. The name of this town.
Okay.
I invented it's a variation on a metal that I saw a while ago. I think the original name for it was Finamagus metal. And it was basically anti-magic metal.
Okay.
I kind of retooled it as Magebane steel. I thought it was a little bit cooler. Well, this town's groundwater actually has Magebane in it.
Ooh, geez.
And they're realizing how much water affects everything in a city. Five out of the six of them are spellcasters. Or rely on some type of magic. And they're realizing they can't drink the water. They can't drink any of the they can't eat any of the plants that have been grown in the area. They can't eat any of the meat that's been raised in the area. Oh, they are just not happy with this town whatsoever. And it's been perfect.
That sounds worse than having lead in your water. Jeez.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We have there was another shirt we made for it. It was I went to Rivertown and all I got was this lousy t-shirt. Yeah, they are so ready to be done with this town. So, When it comes to save or die, I think if they make a dumb decision, then a save or die mechanic is useful, but I think it needs to be used sparingly.
I totally agree with that. It's like using spice when you're cooking. Mm-hmm. A little bit goes a long way. But too much and you can ruin the whole meal. And I think it's the same way.
Yeah, that's my belief with a lot of mechanics, is that there's a line that if you cross it for some things, it just makes it not fun anymore. I already make my players worry about what's around each corner, but they're not so worried that they're going to walk around the next corner and something's just going to automatically kill them.
Right.
They are worried about having to make sanity saves, but, you know, that won't kill them immediately.
No, and also I think when it comes to the save or die mechanic, I do think it is dependent in a large part on the rule set that you are using. If you are using something like, I don't know, Advanced Dungeons and Dragons or one of the clones of some of the older systems, it's so easy to create a new character. It's not a huge deal. Yeah. You do that in Pathfinder, or you know, you could be spending hours with an app helping you just to get your new fourth level caster back online.
Hey Billy, I know you scheduled time to come and play with us, but make a saving throw. Oh, you failed? Go sit in the corner and make a character for the rest of the night. I'm less interested.
Yeah, so I think that game mechanic, like, as a mechanic, it's very dependent on the rule set that you're playing with. You know, even 5e, which is a lot less heavy than Pathfinder, takes an investment to, especially if you're going to be creating a character, you know, greater than first level. Takes an investment into getting that character up and ready. So save or die can be a mechanic in the game that is detrimental to just gameplay, more so than in older systems. So yeah, it's an interesting question. I love asking, because the different takes on it are not just eye opening, but it allows even me to look to learn and think of new ideas and evaluate my own stand on it.
One of the things I have told my players in some situations, because as you mentioned, it can take a lot of time to build a character. If there is a case where, oh shoot, somebody died very early in a session, I'll have them stick around, maybe play an NPC for a little while. But one of the things I bring up to them is I say, if you want to continue this character, because this is fantasy and the afterlife is a place that you can actually go to, I say, if you want to continue your character's story, we can look at doing so. This character can find a way to pull themselves out of the grave. That doesn't mean they're not going to come out unscathed. There's going to be some things different about them. But if they're like, no, I just want to play a new character, it'll be like, okay, they're dead. They'll stay dead. I did also mention to them a few times, like, oh, there may be some cases that you can't bring them back. If it's like, oh, I sold my soul to so-and-so.
Yeah. And I died.
Sorry, you're going to have to make a new character. So I'm very lenient to that because of how much investment people put into their characters. And it can be a very interesting story to see, well, what happens when they get dragged back from the dead.
Right.
So there's resurrect spells for a reason.
Oh, yeah. You know, so I don't know if this applies in 5e, but I know in first edition, you know, raised dead resurrection would age the caster. So it's like you're not going to go, it's like going down to
I think
urgent care.
But that's a really good one.
Yeah, so it makes it like, well, if it's going to age me 3 years by casting it, I better be getting one hell of a donation. I'm not just going to do it willy-nilly.
I actually made it a little bit harder to resurrect people in my world. I actually have it that the God of Death, if you resurrect someone without her approval, that person will get a mark on them. Wherever, if they had to use a touch spell to resurrect the body, it'll show up there. But what that mark does is it then signals out to basically the religion that follows the goddess of death to hunt this person down and bring them back to the land of the dead.
Well, that's actually pretty interesting. I like that. That's cool. Yeah,
it was my way of explaining why is resurrection magic not overpopulating the world? How are people able to die? And on the note of like aging, I realized I actually had a mechanic in my world as well that necromancers, when they like raise skeletons and other undead things, they actually have to like pay a small fee to the goddess of death to borrow those souls. I just did it the opposite way. They didn't age. It was their maximum lifespan was being decreased. So,
okay.
It was an interesting story mechanic. It was my way of being like, yeah, bringing the dead back, not as fun as you think it is.
No, hey, listen, you can always mix up the soul that comes back with the body.
Oh, yeah, that would be a good one.
It's always fun to mess with the dead. Well, at least in gaming.
Yes, don't do it in real life.
Yeah, there's repercussions for that, usually legal ones. But, all right, so let's hit our last question, and then we'll start sandboxing we'll be like free range chickens, just we'll roam where we're gonna go. But you came into gaming about 9 years ago,
roughly,
and you were in high school, so you were a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
What was that teenage you came into gaming, got introduced, and killed that cleric in that first session? Think of where you're at now in the community with what you're involved in and what your fingers are in the different pies that you have in. What did that teenage you think?
I think teenage me would be quite surprised, largely because of that my ambitions at the time were towards video games. And he probably wouldn't have thought, wow, this random game that I walked up to and killed this character, wow, I'm going to make this a career. Even if it's, I'm in the seat where the DM was. I do not think, it's not too far of a cry. I think he would have been able to understand kind of that gap, but he probably would have been like, what happened? What about video games? Why did you abandon that? Which would have been a very hard conversation of, well, the video game industry is pretty fickle.
Yeah.
And so
the RPG industry, it's easier to get involved in, especially these days. Self-publishing and InDesign, everything else.
There's a far lower barrier to entry to get into tabletop RPG design than it is to get into video games, at least in some competitive sense.
Right.
Because, yes, you can get into indie game design, but you're competing within the indie game sphere. You're not going up against... You're realistically not going up against some of the giants. There's a few cases where, yes, an indie game is a massive hit, Minecraft being one of them. I think Fez was another one that was an indie game and just exploded. It also doesn't help that even within the AAA sphere for video games, like, you're not guaranteed a job at the end of that project. Where a lot of the tabletop people are like, oh, you're part of that project? It's unlikely that you're going to leave.
Right, because tabletop RPGs have a longer lifespan. Whereas video games, I hate to say it, a lot of times it's one and done, especially if it doesn't turn into a franchise.
Yeah, that is 100% true. It is interesting that getting into video games costs way more because you buy one game and, well, you beat it. Oh, I beat it. Well, unless it's... there's some games that have managed to extend their lifespan so much more. League of Legends being one of them. I do not play that anymore because it makes me incredibly angry. There was a stream that I ranted at the end of. The other nerds of Nerdlopedia were just so happy that I was so ragey at that game. And I realized, wow, I don't need to be this angry at this game. I can just stop playing. So, it was largely just trying to keep up with the game because I don't think that's a game that new people can really get into now. It's mostly the same people just continuously playing it. Which is the unfortunate thing about multiplayer games, in the video game sphere, at least.
Oh, yeah. I'll be the first one to admit that for years I was playing way too many MMOs with my old gaming group. The guys that I was gaming with in high school and college transitioned to EverQuest and Anarchy Online and City of Heroes and all that stuff. And they are still doing it, but now it's... what was that first person shooter taking place in New York City? I should know it because I own the game, my Xbox, and actually never that Destiny? No.
No, Destiny doesn't take place in New York.
No. Oh god, and I can picture it too. It's a first person shooter with some playing aspects to it, and they've been playing it now for the last couple of years, and
part of me wants to say one of the Tom Clancy games.
No, I don't think it was a Clancy. I don't think it was a Clancy game, but you know what? I'd have to go to my living room. I'd have to go to my living room. The disc is sitting in a drawer, and I find that I don't play as many video games as I thought I would, especially since I'm retired technically, because they are a huge time sink. Like, I could afford the time sink when I was working a 40-hour work week because I needed the escape. And now that I'm not working a 40-hour work week, I know that if I start playing video games again without putting some kind of limit on it, that'll be my full-time employment, is playing video games. I guess it's like an alcoholic acknowledging that it's an all or nothing. For me, it would be pretty much all or nothing. And then nothing else that I like to accomplish, like, I don't know, podcasts, blogs, gaming content, and other stuff. It just wouldn't get done.
Yeah, a majority of my gaming time now is largely with Nerdlopedia, because Wednesdays we have a couch co-op day. We actually have in our setup, we have two couches, one on the floor, and then we built like a frame that we set the other couch on top of and behind the other couch, so it's like tiered seating. And we sit in, either we're playing a one-player game where we're kind of all just shooting the shit and making fun of each other. Everyone's favorite game is to watch me play Dark Souls, because they love seeing me just get get wrecked. But that's largely the only time I really have to play video games these days. On occasion, I follow quite a few YouTube channels. On occasion, there will be a YouTube channel that covers a game that it's about a interesting mechanic within the game.
Okay.
The most recent one was Mark Brown's Game Maker's Toolkit. He discussed Slay the Spire, which is it's like a deck building card game video game, roguelike, actually. It's weird.
Really?
And I actually sat down and I played that game for honestly way too long, but I actually played it because he was discussing how it does such a very good job of covering synergy within a game and how different mechanics play together really well. And I wanted to sit down. I'm like, well, I want to see this. I'm a designer. I gotta absorb this stuff. And so on occasion, if there's something that's like really stands out that one of the many design YouTube channels I watch talk about, I'm like, okay, I gotta play it and learn from it. So.
It's funny because I was playing some Van Helsing game on my Xbox until Game Hole in November. And when I came back from Game Hole, my Xbox has gone on almost every night, but mostly to stream stuff from Netflix or Amazon Prime. And I want to go back to play it. And at the same time, it's like, it's going to be a time sink. And I don't know. I guess I need to find the exceptional game that's going to be my time sink. I think I could justify that, but not just mindless time sink, because I can do mindless time sync watching YouTube videos that will actually give me an idea of some news that's going on in the world, update my knowledge. But
my pastime is if the content that I put out with Nerdlopedia and also with Smunchy Games, it's all fun stuff. It's like, hey, we're all having a great time. My experience watching YouTube and Netflix is nothing like that, for the most part. I watch educational shows on YouTube. I'm learning about biology, physics, just... I follow a channel that talks about mathematics. To put it as I think I had it on my Twitter profile, I'm a professional nerd.
Oh, well, there you go.
There is no subject that I will not end up researching at some point. And all of it is in combination to help me actually world build better. Cool ideas for that. I love watching like nature documentaries and keeping a notepad nearby.
Oh, nice. That's an idea.
There's some crazy stuff in nature that is just twisted, and you can make some awesome monsters from it.
Especially from the oceans, yeah.
Yes. I think one of the shows that I watched that I've only seen a few episodes too, and it was fantastically inspiring. It's like The World's Weirdest Events or something. It's on Netflix, and one of the creatures was this, I don't remember the exact terminology for it, but it's like one of those shelled, bisected insects. They're in the same family as like centipedes and stuff, but there's some in the ocean.
Oh, damn.
And one of them actually like will get inside of a fish's mouth, latch onto the tongue, and suck its blood.
Lovely.
It is horrifying, but it inspired me to eventually work on like a mind controlling creature.
Nice.
That crawls into their mouth and controls them that way. So just weird stuff like that.
Listen, my vices, I guess, podcast wise, it's stuff they don't want you to know and stuff you should know, which is great for weird history and conspiracy stuff.
Oh,
great things.
So much fun to learn from.
Oh yeah. And I'm a subscriber to the Great Courses Plus. So
nice.
Oh yeah, my last year on the job was on the midnights, manning a desk, and I used to watch the Great Courses Plus on my tablet with my fellow sergeants and lieutenants around me. We would find the unsolved crimes, and you'd have like a forensic scientist leading you through this, and that's like, man, this is good stuff. And then I was like, yeah, I got to subscribe fully.
If you like that kind of stuff, there's a group called the Parcast Network. They do a lot of really cool shows. They have a few on historical figures. I was actually listening to that one today. That one's cool to listen to because they focus on like one person in history and just talk about them for an hour.
Nice.
But then they have other ones like there's Kingpins, which talks about nothing but drug lords. And like they have so much variety. There's one about conspiracy theories, assassinations, just you name it. They're probably working on it. And they even have one about cultists, which is.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, they have so much content and it's so good. It's one of the few podcasting groups that I actually listen to these days, because I used to listen to a ton of D&D podcasts and stuff. I'd listen to actual plays, I'd listen to discussion podcasts. But then after a while, I realized that I wasn't really getting as much out of those as I used to.
Right.
And so I ended up turning to more like the educational stuff. There's a podcast I started following called Grammar Girl, because I'm also a bit of a writer. So I'm always trying to learn new things about, you know, how to improve my writing. And it's just, it's interesting that I think even a year ago, my podcast list was completely different than what it is today.
No, I believe that. And I still listen to gaming podcasts, but I don't listen to podcasts as often as I used to, because I used to have a daily commute.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you drive to work, you drive home to work, you podcast from the moment I left the house to the moment I got to my front door coming back. I mean, that was what I did. Now, I listen to podcasts if I got to, like, you know, drive out and watch my niece because she's sick, or pick her up from school or whatever. But it's not daily like I was. And I really should carve time out of my day to go back to listening to all the podcasts I'd like to, because I don't watch too much live TV. Like I'll binge on certain series as they come up, but live TV is what you put on like the Food Network as you're eating dinner. So you have that mindless shit going on behind you as opposed to something you need to focus on.
Yeah. I don't watch, we actually don't even have cable at my house, cause we stream everything. If we have something we want to watch, we've got YouTube, Netflix. I'm subscribed to Funimation because I'm an anime junkie too.
Okay.
But I'm very fortunate that the job that I have, I'm a software developer. And so when I'm sitting there coding, I have podcasts running. So for the most part, I'm able to consume podcasts only when I'm at my job.
Fair enough. So, And a lot of people have that ability. I know a lot of people. It's like, I love the fact that your podcast is a daily podcast, because I consume like 8 hours of podcasts at work every day. It's like, damn, I was never that lucky.
Yeah. Usually it's my whole day isn't listening to podcasts. Sometimes silence is fantastic, because I am such a busy person that sometimes I don't have a moment of just nothing.
Right.
So it's great sometimes to just hear silence. Sometimes I'll have actual music playing, or I'm actually talking to someone else about some issue that we're working on, blah, blah, blah. And so sometimes I can get about 1 to 2 hours of podcasts in if it doesn't wear me out.
I gotcha. Like I said, I was probably listening about an hour and a half to 2 hours a day. Now I'm probably somewhere around 2 to 3 hours a week. But I gotta change that.
Yeah, I for being a content creator myself, I was very much invested in listening to all ranges of different podcasts and seeing live streams and stuff, because that's what I was working to produce. And I was like, okay, well, I want to see what other people are doing. I want to get an idea of, okay, well, what's working and what's not.
Right.
And it's actually the only reason I watched Critical Role for like a few months, but then I ended up dropping it off because I'm like, I cannot dedicate 4 hours a week to this.
Oh, yeah, it's a bit much.
Especially because when it starts for me, it's 10 o'clock in the afternoon. And it runs until almost 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, no, I can't keep this up.
Yeah, that can be a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now that I'm also working with Smudgy Games, I have even less time. So,
well, yeah, we haven't really even touched much on what you do for Smudgy. So what do you do for Smudgy?
So, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, I'm the lead game designer on Path's World of Idea, which I think we posted in here, is going live on Kickstarter the 23rd.
Oh, nice.
And my main job has been to get all the rules for Paths to function and play out how we feel the game should be played. I know immediately when people pick up the game, there's going to be rules they're going to throw out. There's going to be rules they're like, oh, that's really cool. People are going to add to it. That's completely fine for me. My job is to make sure that the experience we present is how we think that the world of Idea should feel. So.
That works. That's a lot of responsibility too, for somebody who has their own gig and a real job.
Yes, it's been a fun experience though. I've truly enjoyed working on Paths as a whole. Of course, I'm still working on it. Just because we're going to Kickstarter doesn't mean everything is set and done. There's always more stuff that we're tweaking and just trying to get everything to feel right. And yeah.
And obviously this is going to be this is the first Kickstarter for Smudgy Games.
That is correct. It's one of those moments for us that it's a little bit of I'm not panicking, you're panicking.
if you weren't panicking, you wouldn't have the proper respect for Kickstarter. So
yeah, it's unnerving, but it's also exciting because it's like, wow, everything's kind of coming together now, and just. I don't know. It's just super exciting, and I can't wait to see how it's going to turn out.
Well, I mean, I've seen how organized Smudgy Games is, so I'm expecting that this is going to go pretty smoothly right out of the box, but hopefully you won't prove me wrong.
The goal isn't to prove you wrong there.
I know.
But yeah, no, things have progressed. There have been things that changed since I think it was like the 1.7 edition. A lot of things changed from 1.7 to 1.8 of the beta version. So it's but we've gotten very good responses from a lot of the changes that we've made and just what we've been doing. So I love hearing tester feedback where they're like, oh yeah, we had such a fun time. And a small part of me inside just kind of sighs in relief, like, okay, good. Something went right.
And that's what you should get. I mean, listen, the last game that last role-playing game I beta tested was D&D Next 5e.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we got in early. We were friends and family. And I'll be honest with you, getting early is probably not always the best time to get in, because every 2 to 3 weeks we'd have a new playtest package that often was nothing like the prior playtest package that you had.
Yeah, that's
it was so early on that the rules were changing so fluidly. In the end, we just got frustrated, and it was the way it was good. We were doing this the virtual tabletop, and as a group, we made a lot of connections amongst ourselves, and we really bonded. So, and our GM was totally burned out on running Next at that point. So, who wants to volunteer to, run the next campaign? And there was a lot of not it's, and all of a sudden I was the last one standing. But it was good. So, I mean, the experience was very frustrating for us, but it was, in the end, it was great because we got a good, really strong gaming group that stayed together for, I don't know, 6-7 years. They're still gaming on Saturday nights. My Saturday nights are now occupied by my 8-year-old niece spending most weekends. So Uncle doesn't have much game time on the weekends anymore.
I get that. We play our game on Friday, and that's the only day of the week that we play. And every day I've got something listed as do this, do that. I know Katie hates it sometimes that I'm just so busy all the time, but for me it's, well, there's things I want to do, and if I don't do them, they're not going to get done.
My wife Rachel is very understanding. She was very encouraging. She's really what got me back into gaming, because I didn't game for, I don't know, about probably 12 years or so. In between, like, when your work schedule goes from weekends off to Wednesday, Thursday, and you're working 5:30 at night to 2 a.m. in the morning, you don't really have anything that would actually work with other people in your gaming group. And I stepped away from gaming for a number of years, and Rach encouraged me to get back into gaming, at least via virtual tabletops, and encouraged me with the blogging and the podcasting and everything else I've done. Having a supportive spouse is amazing.
Yes. Despite some of Katie's feelings of being upset, she has been incredibly supportive of the things I've done and the things I'm doing. So it's, she understands I'm trying to make a living doing this kind of thing.
Right. Make a living doing what you enjoy and what you love. Yeah. Rachel's the same way, and she gets frustrated. Frustration is certainly part of the process, but I couldn't do all this without her. So, I know where to, where to place the blame. It's good blame, certainly blame nonetheless.
Yeah, without Katie, I'd probably be 100 pounds lighter, but I'd also be malnutritioned. So.
That's
a balance. Job of keeping me alive.
that is a hell of a balance. Yes.
Yeah. So.
Well.
Yeah. This has been. This has been the first tabletop RPG that I've actually done, like, design work over the whole system. But I can't say that's the first game I've designed, because in college, I was part of a group called Husky Game Development. It was called that because I went to school at Michigan Tech University, and our mascot was a husky, a dog.
Okay.
So, and I actually designed some computer games. Designed, programmed computer games with that. And it's actually some of the first experience I had in game development that I had a team leader role as well. So I guess it was a little bit fitting into this role kind of worked out.
But you had a little experience in something that, was a parallel responsibility, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And with work in Nerdalopedia, I've done a lot of homebrewing for Dungeons and Dragons. So I had also dived a little bit into designing for tabletop, but I hadn't gone through a whole system before, and this has been an eye-opening experience.
Well, we got pretty much a week to the Kickstarter, so that should be interesting.
Yeah, that'll be fun to see how that goes. Meanwhile, I will be very anxious the whole time.
That is not a bad thing. Again, respect of Kickstarter is, and the whole process is something that's very important. Because if you don't respect it, you are increasing your chances of falling on your face. And certainly got to have healthy respect for the process. That's great.
Indeed.
And I'm going to tell you right now, remind me when it launches so I can get the word out.
All right. And I know Smunchy has been posting quite a bit in the Smunchy Games chat here on
Discord here?
Yeah, on your Discord. He actually posted a link to the Twitter post we had for the Kickstarter preview page.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, except when it goes live, I'll put it up on the blog side and share it willy-nilly across my social media. But I'm looking forward to it, because I know Smunchy talked a lot about it with me, mm-hmm. and it looks like a really interesting beginning, because there's more coming after this in different ways, and I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. It's also been a little bit, on the design side, a little bit nerve-wracking, because the book that we're producing, the player's guidebook for the game, kind of sets the foundation for what we do in the future. And so there's a little bit more pressure on this project to get it as close to right as we possibly can. So.
Well, I think you've got a good team with you. I don't think that's going to be much of an issue. But again, I'm glad to respect the process, because not saying it's a large number, but there's certainly a number of folks that use Kickstarter that really don't respect the process that it goes into it, and that's like the successful failures are what results from that.
Yes, indeed.
But
so
you got Smunchy,
Yes, talking with him, he has reassured me on plenty of times, because I've also done some personal research into Kickstarter, just because it's so prevalent in today's design space anyway, that it's mm-hmm. hard to not look at or hear about. And so I looked at it myself and tried to, I followed some designers who have gone through Kickstarter and listened to all these different things. So I had a list of questions when we were working on designing the Kickstarter that I passed through Smunchy, and he reassured me on like all of them. And I'm like, okay, I feel a lot better about this now, because you're not falling into traps that I've seen.
And there are a lot of traps out there, big and small. And my most amusing trap in my mind is I understand that everybody says you got to do a video. You have to include a video with your Kickstarter page, which isn't true, but I understand why it said. Mm-hmm. But if you are going to do a video, it shouldn't be of you sitting at your living room sofa in dirty white socks with your feet up on a table.
No.
That was a Kickstarter that I found in my time, and I was like, my God, this is one of those big no's. Somebody told you, you've been better off without a video in that case.
Yeah. It makes me very happy, the video we do have on it. It turned out really good.
Well, I'm looking forward to the video. I'm looking forward more so to the Kickstarter.
Yes.
So, good times. We covered a lot of ground. And I told you before the show, we're going to cover ground that neither one of us expects to. And we did.
So much stuff. Time, I have to say.
Well, good, because I was about to ask you, was this nearly as stressful as you probably thought about it beforehand?
I will say I probably came into this a little more anxious than I should have been. I think it's largely because this is one of the first times I've actually... I will actually say this. This is the first time I've been, I guess, interviewed on a podcast before.
Okay.
It's not the first time I've been on a podcast, because with Nerdlopedia, we started one a while ago. We had to put it on hiatus due to time issues. So,
I'm sure. It can certainly be time consuming, especially if you worry about things like, I don't know, sound level, editing out like offensive language and other things, which I don't give a fuck about. So, this podcast has the technical level of let me bring a bot into the room, and unless the sound levels are really off, what I got is what my audience gets, and so far it's worked. But I know others that will tinker with a 10-minute podcast for 2 hours to get everything right, and I can't.
That was close to the approach we took, and our editor hated our voices by the end of it.
I'm sure. I think if I had to go in my own stuff, I'd probably want to get myself a new voice box at the end, because I not like listening to myself all that many times. So
so before we actually were streaming to Twitch, we actually started it as a YouTube channel, and mm-hmm. I edited enough of our videos that my voice does not infuriate me anymore. I still don't like it, but it's not so bad that I can't listen to myself.
And that's the funny thing, because I think it applies to almost everybody. We do not like our voice when we hear it played back. We like how our voice sounds in our head. But once it comes back to me from a speaker, I'm like, that's me. I sound like that. What the hell? But yeah, I've gotten used to it now, I guess.
Yeah. It's something I didn't actually ever expect to have to deal with.
Welcome to my world. Congratulations.
Yeah. So.
Well, Jacob, this was a good time, man.
It was. It was a lot of fun.
Listen, that's the whole point, and it should be a lot of fun. You shouldn't have to sit in a podcast and be interviewed and go, did we hit all the bullet points? Oh, my God. We went off script. Are we going to have to take out those 7 minutes? I dropped the F-bomb. Holy fuck. We got to take that out. No, it all stays, man.
I think on our podcast, our editor put, like, random animal noises over our swearing. And I can't remember if that was a choice that we had made as a group or if it was just because they thought it was funny.
You know, my old gaming group, we thought, we considered at one point, like, recording our sessions. And then I had to point out, if we recorded our sessions and we wanted to make it family friendly, about 30% of the noises would be bleeped out. And while it might make it, you know, it might be a great podcast for Mad Libs, it would not make for a great podcast or YouTube or anything of that sort. So
our Twitch channel, we have it listed as 18 plus because none of us can hold back our language. It also doesn't help that I have a reputation as a DM to basically kill child characters.
Awesome.
So to put it into perspective, I am more of a dark fantasy writer. And my games reflect that. I do creepy, scary stuff than some people probably prefer. So we were just like, yeah, 18 plus, we're not going to deal with it. We swear a lot. We talk about boobs and stuff. It just doesn't matter.
It is what it is. And why hide it, man? I don't like sanitized, personally. I mean, and I've... there are some podcasts that are very well produced, but they're so sanitized.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel real. And I'm not saying you should be, you know, cursing like a 20-year veteran of the NYPD. What I am saying is that you should sound at least like the average person.
Yeah. There are some cases in which sanitization is funny.
Yeah, okay, I'll grant you that.
Because there's, even with, like, dropping swear words, sometimes the situation is not as funny until you hear that bleeping noise.
Fair enough. I will give you that.
It's not all the cases, but it's there have been more times than not that I've laughed at that. So.
Yep. Well, I think that we have reached the end, but... I will say this publicly, Jacob. After we get through the first round of the fireside chat, we're going to do a second round, and I certainly like you to come back because this is a good time.
Oh, I would absolutely love to come back. It was a blast talking with you. Our first conversation starting with cats was a very good sign.
Well, definitely, man. Yeah. Well, yeah, that my talking about my food poisoning over the weekend. What more? If you can't bond over cats and food poisoning, you're just done to me, man. You're just done. Seriously, man. Thank you. This was really good. And the Kickstarter release is
April 23rd,
which is a week from today.
Yeah.
It's holy shit.
Absolutely crazy.
Well, folks, I'm going to, in the show notes, links to not just Smudgy Games, but whatever. I can't say it. I'm not going to try to say it. You say it, Jacob.
It's Nerdlopedia. The best way to
remember it. Nerdlopedia. Okay.
It's like Encyclopedia, but for nerds, which is kind of a tautology.
Well, I will have links to both in the show notes for this. So, again, huge thanks to Jacob for showing and participating tonight. And of course, the Smudgy Games crew in the background listening in. And as always, folks, stay safe, be well, God bless. Those dice. I will talk with you all tomorrow. Later, folks.